Yeah, the one's in. Call the meeting to order. First item is approval and review minutes.
Move adoption.
A second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, you're up, John. Committee report.
Since last the council convened, we only have one committee approval to report, and that was on December 15th. The real estate committee approved a $250 million commitment to Windsor Columbia Realty Fund. And while I've got the floor, I'd also like to introduce our new OIC members who are going to the audience. First, we have our new treasurer, the 29th treasurer of the state of Oregon, Tobias Reed. Treasurer Reed's background includes several years in the Oregon State Legislature, commercial experience at Nike, and he actually started his career in Washington at the U.S. Treasury. We also have Rick Miller joining the council. Rick is a seventh-generation Oregonian with deep professional experience in private equity and real estate, which is happily consistent with some of the things we do here. So on behalf of staff and your council peers, Treasurer Reed, Mr. Miller, welcome.
Thank you.
Next up on the agenda is special officer election.
Madam Vice Chair, I'd like to nominate you as chair and Mr. Russell as vice chair.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Rex, here's your chance. Excellent. John, I'm not sure what you've gotten yourself into, but here we go. Third item, private equity review. Mike, you're up. If you don't mind introducing yourself for the new board members.
Absolutely. First off, welcome to our new board members. Very exciting to have you both here. We've met before, but as a reminder, my name is Mike Langdon. I oversee on a day-to-day basis the OPR private equity program.
Mike, is your microphone working?
Is it better?
Better.
Yeah. I'm joined at the dais by Tom Martin. Tom's with Torrey Cove, and for your orientation, Torrey Cove is the OIC's investment consultant for the private equity program, as well as for the opportunities and alternatives portfolios. This morning, we wanted to give you an update on the private equity program and then walk you through some of the initiatives we wanted to focus on next year. There's several documents in your package, but our intention is only to walk you through the OST 2017 Private Equity Annual Plan and Review, which is tab 3.01 in the package. Our plan would be to give you a brief update on the state of the markets, then we'll follow up with an overview of what we accomplished last year, of a little bit more involved discussion of our performance, because I think there's some important takeaways to be had there, followed by an update on the current exposures of the program, and then finally we'll propose our plan and initiatives for 2017. So we've got a lot of materials to go through, and only about 50 minutes to get through it. We obviously have prepared remarks, but fully anticipate there'll be discussion and questions. So please direct us, ask questions whenever you want, and we'll present as you see fit. So to get us started, I'll take us through a quick update on the state of the markets, which in the presentation begins on page 4. And really, the headline here is that it's a hot market out there, no question about it. I think if you look at it from strictly from a volume standpoint, for activity, it's not going to look like a material uplift from the volumes we saw last year. M&A transaction volumes, leverage finance issuance, new deal activity in private equity and fundraising all are broadly in line with what we saw last year. But if you dig into the details a little bit deeper, you'll see it's a hot market in two important respects. First, purchase prices. The private equity saw purchase prices hit all-time highs, and we'll get into a minute the practical impacts of that. And then secondly, the heat in the fundraising market and how that impacts us on a day-to-day basis. So from a purchase price standpoint, it should be no surprise, the valuations of risk assets in this current environment are high across the board relative to historical norms, and obviously that's going to follow through. The valuation of stakes in public companies reflects the broader environment for pricing. But as we look further at the data, we're setting record highs of purchase prices at the same time that, leverage levels, or the amount of debt used to finance deals, hasn't moved up in a proportional manner. If you look at the average deal last year, it was financed with roughly 50% equity, and if you think about historically, leveraged buyouts are financed with somewhere between 20 and 40% equity. So much more equity in the capital structure. High-priced environment, less reliant on leverage, which would suggest that our managers really need to execute perfectly against their value creation plans. They need to generate high levels of operating performance growth to make the LBO math work and to get us to high teens or low double digits or low 20s sort of gross returns at the portfolio company level. Now, I would say that the quality of the companies that the market is acquiring is good. Private equity, as a rule, is buying better companies today than it bought 10 years ago. But again, when you put together high prices and low leverage, you really need to generate high single-digit or low double-digit CAGRs of earnings growth to make the math pencil out. So what I would leave you with there is we're relatively sober with our expectations about the deals that have been done the last couple of years and what the upside looks like for those transactions. Secondly, from a fundraising standpoint, again, I think the volumes we'll see raised in 2016 will look similar to what they looked like in 2015, but there remains sort of a fundamental supply-demand mismatch in the asset class. There's a lot more appetite to invest in private equity on the part of institutions like ourselves than there is supply in the market. To put a finer point on that, in 2016, it's estimated that 90% of the funds that were raised either hit or exceeded their target. So 9 out of 10 managers that came to market either had a good or a very good fundraising. For comparison's sake, if you look back at 2006 and 2007, probably 60 or 70% of the managers that raised capital hit or exceeded their benchmark. And that was really the last time a decade ago that we saw a lot of new capital come into this market. At that point, there was a lot of new supply that came to market, so a lot more managers raising larger funds. So the supply-demand dynamics sort of balanced out. In this market, the mismatch is much more acute. And the practical impact of that is managers are coming to the market, raising capital very easily. The processes are very fast, and they're sort of dominating the discussion from a terms perspective when we negotiate. What we need to do is be mindful of this as we think about how we think about our forward pipeline, how we manage the processes from a timing standpoint, and how we work our relationships very hard to try and protect, in many cases, the allocations that we're looking for. The reality of it is fundraising is cyclical like anything else. So I'm not going to paint a picture that these issues are always going to be as acute as they are today. But I think we need to be mindful of the fact that the drivers behind the supply-demand mismatch are likely going to be secular in nature. And by that I mean it's really the excess appetite to invest in private equity that's driving this dynamic. Possibly new supply will come online at some point, and that'll have its own impact on expected returns. But when we think about the demand to be in the private equity asset class, that's really driven by long-term expectations for returns and people trying to hit their return hurdles. And it's unclear when that dynamic is going to change. So with that, that's a real brief overview of the market. I'd ask Tom maybe if he has additional comments, and we're happy to take any questions on that topic.
Well, I think the demand feature is really driving increase in fund sizes, and that's a key focus area for us in diligence. When you've got increasing pools of capital, and you tend to see potential strategy creep, and it gets harder and harder to replicate historical performance. So that's something we're acutely focused on as we think about putting capital out going forward.
Tom and Mike, do you mind telling us a little bit more about where those other pools of capital are coming from? Historically, we competed with, you know, peer plans around the country. Are we seeing a change in who's out there and competing with you for allocations?
I think there's certainly been a long-term shift. Historically, the source of capital for the asset class was public pension plans first in the U.S., and then insurance companies and corporate pension plans. Increasingly, public pension plans in the U.S. are important, but Canadian pension plans are larger, and sovereign wealth funds are really the big new pools of capital that have come online in recent years. I think longer term, There's huge appetite from the ultra-high net worth market, and there's appetite on the part of the GPs to access sort of the mass affluent market. So I think today as we sit here, our big competition is really from the large sovereign wealth funds. 10 years down the road, I think we're going to have a lot of competition from more retail-like channels.
So the upside of having here public plans as your competitors is that you had a similar push on the liability side to meet hurdle rates, right, that were comparable. Is the change in the competitors for allocation also driving some trends, other trends in terms or other parts of the negotiation process that at some point we should probably talk a bit more about?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's different, very different sensitivities when you look at the different classes of investor. As you say, our need to generate returns, to offset offset our liabilities is the sort of guiding principle for us. If you are a $1 trillion sovereign wealth fund, as much as anything, it's a diversification exercise. So it's about getting money to work, which means you're fundamentally less sensitive about terms. And the real pressure is, frankly, to get the money to work. So at any cost, you'll get it done. We have seen that show up. It hasn't materially moved a lot of the economic terms yet. So I don't want to paint a picture of disaster, but I think you're touching on something very real, that the sensitivities are different, and our ability to sort of dictate terms is not what it was 10 years ago, because we've really, I mean, to put a final point on it, we're in discussion with one of our larger managers now about making a maximum commitment, so a $500 million commitment, that would be the recommendation. At that size, we'll be somewhere between 15 and 20th largest investor, whereas a decade ago, that would have been by far the biggest investment. So our weight in the market is different than what it was before.
Mm-hmm. Some of the sovereign wealth funds have lower long-term return expectations, too. So there's a whole new product development that's going on around much longer duration holds and lower returns relative to the traditional private equity model. And that seems to be a where a lot of capital is starting to be aggregated from some of those investors as well.
Michael, there's two sides of the coin. We're buying private equity, but then they're selling it. And if they're able to sell it in an environment which is frothy, that's probably a good thing for us. What you don't want to do is get caught when those things are changing. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think it's certainly safe to say that the last couple of years have been hot, and that's showing up in our distributions and in the asset class of distribution. So a lot of the inventory in terms of the portfolio companies that made up the collective NAV has turned over the last couple of years. In many cases, we're sort of trading between private equity firms, so our stays in the private equity ecosystem. So we will, in a lot of cases, be on both sides of the trade. But I think it's been, your point is an accurate one. It's been a very hot market for exits as well as a hot market to get money to work. So we're seeing both the positive and negative of that. So seeing no further questions, I'll skip ahead a few pages to page 6.
Well, let me
please.
I'm not sure. Okay. Given that both sides of the coin are positive, what's the net effect of all of that? I mean, is there an issue with the market, or do both sides balance?
Well, I think it's
you're focusing on the fact that we pay high prices,
sure,
but on the other hand, we're selling at high prices too. So.
Well, the fact that we're paying high prices won't show up in our results for another 5 years. The benefit of the exits is showing up sort of today. So we get the lag effect is what we're pointing to. Today is a very, very positive realization market, but as we look at the deals that are getting done and we roll the clock forward, if we don't get above trend earnings growth, I find hard to believe that's going to be 20% gross proposition.
But John, I think the point I think we have to follow up on in a later meeting is the understanding that the different competitive set on the entry point will drive some changes in how we've thought about, you know, critical negotiating points. So I think we'll probably have to learn a little bit more about the consequence of having different competitors coming in with us and the fact that we're just not the big fish anymore.
And also, Mike, I would probably venture to guess that it might change the types of managers you might invest with. So would you mind speaking to that a little bit? How does this change your thinking in terms of the types of managers you might look at or be interested in?
The competitive?
Yeah, the fact that the expected return for the next 5 years out plus might be a little bit diminished, which could put some business pressure on some of these managers. Mm-hmm. Right. So how does that change your perception of the manager or the types of managers you might go after? Does it make you feel like you have to go safer? Does it make you feel like you have to be more opportunistic to find managers who are doing different stuff?
I think if you look at the approach we take to manager selection, and we'll come on to that a little bit more later, but historically, this asset class was the one exception of the rule that past performance is a predictor of future performance. It generally was the case historically that you could look at a manager that produced top quartile results and anticipate that they would continue to produce top quartile results. Now, the driver behind that was the fact that it was a small, nascent asset class, and the data set had massive survivorship bias, so it was the successful managers that raised follow-on funds. As the market's gotten much bigger, that relationship has broken down, which is a roundabout way of saying historically we would have focused heavily on the historical quartile rankings. Now it's more of a nuanced sort of analysis of risk weighting the probability the manager would be well into the second quartile versus hoping that they'll be in the top quartile. So, and that risk weighting is a qualitative thing. There's no math that gets us at what the risk of the asset class is. So in our portfolio, I would say, first and foremost, we're not as rigid about the quartile rankings as we probably were before, but to get more to your question, I think you have, once you pass that screen that you're a high-quality manager and you can get us sort of well into the second quartile in a probabilistic manner, there is a mix still of sort of core steady state managers who try and make money and preserve capital on every single deal. And then we still have some managers in there that have a more racy profile and are really looking to try and generate some upside for us. But with that comes a higher probability of risk. So it hasn't fundamentally changed the way we do the analysis. I'm not sure that it's changed the profile of the type of manager we select. Now, there's other things that change that. I mean, the reality of it is, years ago, and so this isn't a recent phenomenon, we had a huge universe of GPs in the portfolio. Now we've narrowed that down to somewhere between 40 and 50. The practical effect of that is, you know, we're spending much, much more of our time in the upper mid-market. So from that perspective, we have more established, larger managers with more resources. So I'd say that would be the bigger change.
Thank you.
So the next part of the presentation takes us through, you know, stops looking at the market and starts to focus on our program specifically. So I'll try and be brief on this, but on page 6 we show our initiatives from last year. So these are the things we talked about executing against when we sat here last year. From an investment standpoint, Tom will come on to this in more detail in a second, but we were really right on plan from this perspective. The second initiative that you see here is the RFP. That was a big project that our team took on middle of last year. We had the benefit of then Vice Chair Rakai Adams and Senior Investment Division staff as well. I was really happy with how we ran that process. I thought it was a nice process that we ran, and ultimately we selected and got approval to re-engage with Torrey Cove. So that was the second initiative. Number 3 is enhanced due diligence and monitoring. Here I would say we've made some progress. but there's more work to be done, and we've already identified some further enhancements. This is an initiative that we've worked on really in collaboration across the alternatives programs, but not just in the private equity portfolio. And it's one that should, frankly, be on the list every year because you never stop on that front. And then the last one I'll draw out on this page would be number four, which was to study solutions for our long-dated portfolio. As I highlighted last year, we have a big cohort of partnerships in the portfolio that are, you know, at or beyond 10 years old in their age, so they're at or beyond their originally conceived useful life. That creates a lot of administrative burden for staff because they're dealing with, in many cases, some complex end-of-life issues. So we looked at a lot of third-party options to, you know, as extreme as selling them those interests and as simple as hiring a third party to take on the administration of those partnerships for us. Ultimately, we settled on pursuing a more collaborative approach and just leveraging Torrey Cove more. So we've identified the solution. We've identified the cohort of funds. We need to go through the cohort and sort of name by name talk about what the right structure and collaboration is. So made some progress on that front last year, but more work to be done in 2017. So with that, I should stop talking about the initiatives, and I'll turn it over to Tom, who can give us some more detail on the specific investments we made last year.
So on the next page, slide 7, is an overview of what actually transpired transactionally last year. And you can see it's a pretty healthy roster of names that were transacted. We were right in line with the plan when we came before the committee last year. We presented the concept of somewhere between $2.5 and $3.5 billion of commitments on a calendar year basis, and we pretty much hit the middle of that. These are all existing relationships except for two new relationships that were brought into the portfolio. As we, for the last several years, we've been very sensitive to the scale of the portfolio, and so we've been operating within a relationship budget framework to try and consolidate down with higher conviction names, upsizing and standardizing commitment levels. So we're trying to streamline that process and make it more efficient and consistent over time. And I think the plan and what we executed on last year is indicative of that. You see good diversification across strategies. Even though it's a small part of the portfolio, there was a healthy dose of venture that got executed against last year. And we tactically pursued a distressed strategy that has some flex capacity to set up for that market opportunity should it evolve in a way that looks like it potentially could. So I think we feel very good about the work that was done to support these decisions. These were high conviction underwritings, I think, and that came across in the materials that were presented and the recommendations that were made. And I think it is a year of activity that's consistent with the general framework of the portfolio that we presented and is consistent really with how we're approaching things going forward that we'll get into in a little bit more detail later on in the presentation.
Tom, the balance between North American and non-North American, is that part of the plan?
I think the general, this portfolio, by virtue of the scale of the program, has and will continue to be sort of developed market dominant. And that really is North America and Europe, with North America being the key anchor and then Europe sort of being a secondary allocation geographically. We have the Asian portfolio is something that has been a focus in the last, 7 or 8 years, but it's still in its infancy in terms of deployment and scaling up. But I think this will continue to be, a developed market buyout centric portfolio for a variety of different reasons.
With the rough ratio that we see here, 1/3, 2/3.
I think we're at about 2/3, basic buyouts, and then everything else makes up the balance. And I think we're just around, just over 2/3 North America today. I don't really envision any fundamental changes to that.
I think if you look at our geographic exposure, you know, it's domestic heavy as compared to the global equities markets and global GDP, but it maps very, very, very directly private equity activity. So private equity continues to be a U.S. dominant asset class. The other big market is Western Europe, but it's not as large as the U.S., and the rest of the world's pretty nascent. So until the rest of the world develops, I think we'll tend to look pretty domestic biased.
And then slide 8 shows the cash flow profile of the program. The blue bars on top are distributions that are coming out of the portfolio. The red bars on the bottom are contributions. And you can sort of take from that directionally that this has been a net cash flow positive program for the last several years. That's a cash flow profile that we forecast to be sustainable for the foreseeable future. And when we get to the pacing, you'll see the model we've created to sort of support that quantitatively. And then you can also see here the allocation, which is coming down. There was a revision to the target 2 years ago from 20% to 17.5%. And we are, as we think about pacing on a go-forward basis, we are sensitive to trying to manage down to that target in a practical way. But maintaining consistent capital deployment and not introducing extreme volatility into pacing to get there.
So if there's no questions on the review of 16, we'll move to the review of OPERF performance. On page 9, we start by presenting the program's performance relative to our benchmark and to the broader private equity asset class. As a reminder, the benchmark for private equity is the Russell 3000 Index plus 3%. And that's really reflective of the role we're meant to play in the portfolio. This is equity exposure, but it's there really to seek higher returns than we can get out of the public markets. And on that basis, if you look at the top half of this slide, I think you'll find that, you know, over the past decade, the program has not generated a material premium to what we could get in the public markets. And if you look at the 3 and 7 year periods, it's actually trailed the public markets. So we'll get into in just a second what the drivers of that underperformance are, but first I want to address an obvious question. Are we looking at a OPERF-specific performance issue, or is this reflective of bigger things that are happening in the asset class? And to speak to that, you can look at the bottom half of this chart. Here we're comparing our performance to the Cambridge Associates Pooled Average. Cambridge, as I'm sure many of you know, is one of the oldest and largest investment consultants in the business. They have for many years maintained a database of several thousand private equity funds, performance of several thousand private equity funds. And based on the depth and the breadth of that database, it's about as close as we're going to get to a proxy for the overall private equity markets. So from that perspective, if you look at the bottom half of the chart, we're sort of right on top of the Cambridge Associates pooled average, which suggests that you know, the issues we're seeing with our performance relative to publics is less a story of OPERF issues and more a broader private equity asset class level issue. So with that statement, let me back up again and dig into the sources of underperformance relative to the public market. And I would start by saying we need to remember that this is a very simple beast, this program. The way we access our private equity exposure currently is really just through primary fund commitments. We're not a big player in co-invest, secondaries, or directs. And that simplicity makes it pretty easy to tease out the attribution factors that are driving the market. So we can go with the classic framework of thinking about what are the factors of market timing, asset allocation, and security selection. In our case, market timing really speaks to how we pace our vintage years. How do we size each vintage year relative to the vintage years that came before and after? Are we pursuing sort of a smooth pace, or are we lumpy coming in and out of the market? Asset allocation for us speaks to the mix of different fund styles we pursue. So are we pursuing primarily venture capital funds, buyout funds, growth funds? What's the mix? What is our mix of developed markets versus emerging markets funds? What is our mix of large funds versus small funds? And then finally, security selection is the easiest to get your arms around. That really just speaks to fund selections. Of all the funds that come to market over time, which subset do we choose to commit to, and how do they perform relative to their peers? So we set out on that with that as a framework to try and do an attribution study of our performance and of the private equity market overall. It was admittedly not a perfectly scientific study based on some limitations in the data. But I would say that the key takeaway, the clear takeaway from my perspective, is we look at the last 10 years, the key driver of underperformance for us was market timing above the other factors. Specifically, it was an overcommitment to the 2005 to 2008 vintage years. Now, if we roll back the clock about 10 years, you may recall that that was a real inflection point for the asset class. Huge amounts of new money came into the asset class as institutional investors started programs or upped their commitment allocation. And with the benefit of hindsight, we can all say that that was very poor timing because a ton of new money went to work immediately before the onset of the financial crisis. So you had a spike up in activity right at the wrong time, and for denominator reasons, you then had a spike down in activity that followed that. The practical result is the NAV exposed to those specific vintage years has dominated the NAV of the entire asset class for the past decade, and it continues to have an outsized influence on the industry today. And frankly, our program at that point was much more mature than most programs, but we were not immune to that effect because right about that time, our target allocation of the asset class increased from 15 to 20%. Now, that was obviously not a market timing decision. That was a strategic allocation decision. But the market timing impact is we followed the same trajectory as the market in that had a big step up in commitment size and then a step down afterwards. To illustrate this a bit more, if we look at the chart on page 10, this lays out our performance by vintage year across our entire history. And as you can see, if you look at 05 through 08, those are really an order of magnitude larger in size than the vintage years that came before and after. And then if you look at the results from those vintage years, the since inception IRRs are relatively weak. As you can see, we're in the second quartile, so it wasn't disastrous fund selection. It was just the fact that we were outsized in some weak performing vintage years. To drill down a little more on how that translates into exposure and how that sticks with us for a very long time, if you look at page 11, this tries to draw out how those commitments translate into vintage year exposures across time. So if you look at where we were at 6/30/16, those vintage years, despite the fact that they were 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, still represented about 45% of our exposure. So in a normalized environment, you would have expected that to have turned into cash and be just a tail exposure. Right now, it's still nearly half of the portfolio. If we roll back 5 years, those vintage years represented 75% of our exposure. So if you think about our five-year result, we started at 75%. We moved to 50%. Those vintages as a cohort were generating relatively weak performance, and that's been the dominant factor in our overall performance. So that's our attempt to sort of illustrate the timing effect and how it's impacted our returns over time. The next factor I would talk to real quickly, and we don't have a slide on it, is asset allocation. I don't have a slide here because it proved to be very challenging to try and measure our asset allocation against the market weight asset allocation because of the quality of the data. And again, as a reminder, here asset allocation refers to the mix of strategies, venture, growth, buyout, the mix of geographies, developed versus emerging, and fund sizes. So we don't have good data on how we specifically compare to the market, but we can again say very definitively that on the basis of our size, we look effectively exactly like the market. There's certainly a lever to be pulled if you're able to dial up and down your venture exposure, your emerging market exposure, or really focus on small funds. That can either help or hurt you over time relative to the market. However, on the basis of our scale, to maintain our overall asset allocation to private equity to 17.5%, we need to put a quantum of capital to work where we really can't create significant variations in those exposures. We, by definition, have to be heavily biased towards developed market buyout funds, large developed market buyout funds, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to hit our bogey in terms of the overall exposure that the plan needs in private equity. So,
Mike, can we pause on that? I'm struggling to make sure I understand. So it sounds like you're saying we're getting so big that we're effectively the market.
In terms of our asset allocation, we look exactly like the market, yes.
And if you go back to slide 9, you're saying we're so big to our, we're comparing ourselves to the Cambridge average, which I think of as the second quartile performance, right? So this number 11.7 at the three-year mark, that's the average performance in the Cambridge universe, regardless of composition of the portfolio, right?
It's capital weighted.
Of our sort of peer set of the whole universe.
And it does look a lot like the median. It won't always every vintage year, but it's close. It's very close.
Yeah, I guess the thing that's troubling about that is we invest in these complex and labor-intensive assets in order to not be average, right? And by virtue of size, it sounds like, you know, the ship is driving us toward average. So what? How do we break that if the focus is on larger relationships and larger checks? This doesn't sound right. Something's not sitting right with me about where we're headed. And so I want to talk a little bit more about what this means, at least to you.
Yep. I think there's two questions there. There's the question of what's private equity going to deliver relative to the public markets.
Right, so that's the top set of data there, which is, okay, is this complexity worth it?
Yeah.
And then the next question is, if we say it's worth it, are we really just shooting for the average performance, or do we have a choice because of size?
Right. So I would say that the levers we have to pull are fairly limited. So if we come back to the three levers I just outlined, sort of market timing, asset allocation, and fund selections, well, sort of those one at a time. Market timing will never be able to time the market perfectly, so we shouldn't overtly try and optimize timing. But we can neutralize timing by trying to be consistent, trying to be steady in how we pace our investments. Asset allocation, I think your point is absolutely dead on. It's to get the capital to work, we are, as a rule, going to look like large buyout exposure, because that's sort of the dominant fundraising.
We're buying the private equity market, so to speak, with those big checks.
From an asset allocation perspective, we are. The last lever would be fund selection. And actually, let me flip forward and speak to that specifically. So fund selection, how are we doing in the funds we're specifically picking? And again, here, the takeaway is going to be that we look an awful lot like the market. So if we measure each of the funds we've picked, each of the mature commitments we've made against a cohort of funds that was in the same vintage year and pursued a very similar strategy, we reveal that about half of our capital went to funds that were above the median, and the second half was below median. So obviously, that's not the picture we want to be painting here. We'd certainly like to see more in the top quartile, and at a minimum, we'd love to see a huge preponderance of the capital above median. That would improve our position pretty strongly. And we are absolutely spending a lot of time, as I talk about enhancements to our due diligence process, that's obviously designed to make this picture look better. I do want to be sober and honest about how far we can push this lever. I don't want to leave you the impression that we're going to be able to get into just top quartile managers and solve the problem that way. I mean, I think there is the manager universe that underlies these quartile rankings probably has somewhere between 9 and 10,000 GPs, but 90% of that manager universe is too small for us to access. So we're really, our theoretical addressable universe is only 10% of the universe. So that 1,000 managers in our database that raise capital of $1 billion or more. But practically, the vast majority of the capital we commit is going to go to an even smaller set of managers that raise several $1 billion. Now, that's not to say that they're bad managers. I mean, they're big for a reason. But the competitive landscape that they operated in is such that the ability to consistently generate huge outperformance like the asset class historically did is not something we should rely on.
Okay, so then is it unrealistic to expect to beat the Cambridge average, right? Not even the median, but the average, given our size and the limit of the universe, right, the manager universe that we're focusing on? Or I guess put another way, the top performers in that cap-weighted Cambridge index, what's the difference between their portfolios and ours, right? So if market timing is not the solution, if manager selection is, you know, the manager pool is limited, if our size is limiting us, right, some, what are they doing? Or is it just that we all pop up, you know, up and down, and it's just a matter of every few years you're at the top and every few years?
Well, venture figures pretty prominently in the Cambridge pool, and that's not a meaningful part of this portfolio. That's something that has been de-emphasized. But I think if you go back a couple of years, given the challenges to put venture dollars to work, we have identified growth equity as a way to get similar high growth exposure. And I think a true testament to the reputation and brand sophistication of OPERB is that we created really one of the first public plan separate accounts with General Atlantic, and that's a pretty innovative structure. It can absorb a lot of capital, and it can accomplish a lot of things for the portfolio in terms of the return profile as well as industry and geographic diversification within one relationship. And so that's, you know, there's no simple answer to any of these questions, but there's a lot of things at the margin that we can do that, if taken in aggregate, can move that needle in terms of what the net performance looks like to get above a median or an average. And I think we feel like with a lot of blocking and tackling that those things can be implemented. It's, you know, scraping for fee concessions and taking economic advantage where we can, pushing on, you know, trying to get ahead of emerging relationships or spin-out groups that can become the next generation of, you know, the core buyout managers today. So a lot of different things around the portfolio that in aggregate over time can help to, I think, improve what the long-term potential looks like. But it's a lot of little things that have to get done and not a simple, straightforward answer to how to alter that trajectory.
You know, I would think that, like we say, and timing, the goal should be to neutralize timing and not fall into bad timing. And asset allocation, it's going to be tough to move the needle. So it has to come from fund selection, but it can come from many different places. First of all, we're not by any means saying that we can't make this picture look better, and we're not trying to make this picture look better. But that, we are realistic about saying we can only push it.
It'll be dramatically better, right?
So what we can do, to Tom's point, is put a renewed focus on the structures we use and the economic terms we get. And that's one of the initiatives we're going to talk about at the end of the presentation, but I think that's where we need to start spending a little bit more time, which is not to say, by the way, that we haven't always tried to get the best deal possible. But as we really take a sober look about what levers we have, that seems like an area where, you know, if we can deliver it, it's risk-free alpha, so to speak. So a little bit more time and attention to that, along with continuing to try and do a better job of selecting funds, is going to help us move up above that median. How far we move above that median, there's a lot of execution between here and there. So I don't want to overpromise, but that's how we've chosen to sort of orient ourselves going forward.
Thank you.
Okay. So we have a summary here about attribution, but we've talked about all that. So I'll turn it over to Tom now to just give us a quick update on our current exposures and the portfolio construction.
So slide 14 is just a quick snapshot of where the portfolio is from a strategy and a geography perspective. You know, sort of in line with the conversation that we're having, you can see about two-thirds of the portfolio is buyout exposure, and the bulk of that is at the larger end of the market. We are generally in all of the target strategies here in line with the plan that we've had in place for the last several years. There really haven't been any material changes to this other than several years ago we de-emphasized fund of funds and venture, and we sort of took the lower bound to zero and turned those in really venture as an opportunistic bucket in the portfolio, and then really fund of funds are not something we're focused on in terms of how to deploy capital through this portfolio anymore. That's a legacy that just doesn't fit the profile of what we're trying to achieve going forward. Growth is now really a focus area, I think, like I said, of a way that we could put venture-like dollars to work with a different, with a little bit more attractive risk profile. And so we continue to think about that. But generally, we're operating in line with the framework that's been in place for a few years now. And geographically, John, to the earlier conversation, you can see, we're three-quarters North America and a quarter international. Those will shift gradually over the ensuing years, but it will not be, we're not forecasting dramatic changes there in terms of what the geographic exposure looks like.
And just one important point, this slide speaks to fund level exposures. The next couple slides will talk about the portfolio companies.
Slide 15 looks at geography again in two different ways. The pie chart on the left looks at the underlying fund level, and then the pie chart on the right looks at underlying portfolio investments. And you can see they are slightly different, but the headlines are fundamentally the same. You do see a lot more European exposure at the portfolio company level. It gets harder and harder to define fund level geography because you have more global and diversified geographic strategies in the market. So that data is weaker than where the underlying portfolio companies actually reside. So we look at portfolio company headquarters as we think about the underlying geographic exposure. The next slide looks at sector exposure, and as you would expect, this is a pretty well diversified portfolio given the maturity and the scale of activity. This shows the year-over-year change in sector exposure, and really the only thing that has changed in a somewhat meaningful way is the TMT or technology exposure has gone up slightly, and I think that's indicative of the market. We've seen a lot of technology-related deals done in the last year, especially in the software space. That's been a really active investment area, across strategies in venture and growth and in buyouts. That's just been a very, very active area and has gotten a little pricey, to Mike's point earlier. But we have seen some changes in the portfolio there. But we look at this as reasonably well diversified. I think there are areas that we opportunistically think about potentially targeting increases in exposure, but that's on a sector focused basis, and finding the right managers to accomplish that can be challenging. But we do, think about sector focused, building out sector focused relationships to alter this slightly when we can, with a high conviction underwriting. And then from a strategy perspective on the next slide, we look at this two different ways. From a fair market value perspective on the left, sort of what is actually out there from an invested capital perspective, and then the unfunded exposure in the bar chart or the pie chart on the right, which is committed but not yet invested dollars. So things that are effectively allocated but not yet drawn down. And again, consistent with our theme today, the predominant exposure here is in the buyout segment of the market. Venture is very, very small, and that is working itself off. There are a few core relationships that we will continue to support, effectively as long as they'll have us. Unclear how long that will survive, but we'll do the best we can to keep the good names. The fund of funds, I think, is important to recognize again as a legacy implementation strategy that is effectively in wind down mode. I don't think you will see us bring a fund to fund structure for consideration. It just doesn't really make sense for the maturity and sophistication of this program anymore. So that should shrink down over time. Unfortunately, there still is unfunded in that of 8%, so that's something that we're going to have that work out over time. And then we are targeting that growth segment as something that we could potentially scale up and make a more meaningful strategy of exposure. And then looking on slide 18, sort of breaks down both fund vintages and deal vintages. Mike's hit this point repeatedly. I think the takeaway is that there's a lot of stale legacy exposure, both from a fund vintage perspective and a deal vintage perspective, that we are anxiously awaiting sort of resolution to work out of the portfolio. I've used the analogy before of an anaconda that eats a very large animal. It takes a long time to sort of get that through the digestive system. We've got something stuck in there that just won't come out, and we're really waiting.
I'm not sure about that analogy.
Yeah. We're waiting for it, so.
Right.
We got to clean the system.
All right.
And then we have, on slide 19, another issue I think that we are proactively trying to manage around. There has been some over-concentration with certain managers within the portfolio. I think if you go back to the slide related to activity last year, and you will see from us more consistent allocation to managers to rationalize and stabilize the larger exposures that we have to sort of consolidate. And we're trying to balance the portfolio so we don't end up with, or so we can manage down some of the concentration that exists today. And this sort of is representative of where we are right now. So in terms of where we're going, slide 20 is the current pacing model. This looks very similar to what we presented last year. We are recommending the same target range of commitments, $2.5 to $3.5 billion. And again, I would expect us to come out somewhere in the middle of that range. We can't control the market from a fundraising perspective, and that's why we build in the flexibility of a range. But at that general pace, for the somewhere between $3 and $3.5 billion for the next couple of years, that we think it gets us on a pretty reasonable glide path down in the neighborhood of the 17.5% target. And I think we're pretty confident about the ability to execute on that plan for the next 3 years. I think it's important, and this goes back to one of Mike's earlier points, when you look out sort of beyond that 3 or 5 year window and think a little bit longer term, the numbers do get very large in terms of what is going to be required to support the 17.5% allocation. And I think we are starting to think, and I think it's a good time to start the conversation about, what are some of the challenges associated with that, and also what are some potential solutions in terms of structurally, are there things that can be done differently in terms of how capital is put to work? Are there relationships that can be leveraged in different ways to help accomplish that? And so that's a preview of a larger issue that we internally think about a lot. I think the story today is that we feel really good about sort of the plan for the next several years and our ability to execute against that. This pacing model is indicative of that, but we do see and are very focused on thinking about how do we continue to scale this over a longer period of time to support the longer-term objectives of the plan.
So, John, one question for you. When we complete the annual asset allocation review, is that just a year-over-year analysis, or do we look at a few years and start to signal longer-term asset allocation concerns?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. It's such a comprehensive exercise, and which is why we put so much time and energy into it. It's so productive for us that we get both near-term and longer-term insight. Mm-hmm. And balancing those dynamics and associated priorities is a challenge, but it's one of the most important things we do.
What time of year is it?
December, early December.
Early December. Okay, so it sounds like Tom's throwing down the gauntlet for us as we think about next year's asset allocation discussion. Received. Gauntlet received. That we think a little bit further out, at least how we might meet the allocation to 17% as the fund grows. That might be something we need to add to our discussion list.
And if you're remiss in mentioning / reminding the council that we have staffing issues in this group too, so we've got a lot going on.
Yeah.
We'll be recruiting.
Again, another gauntlet thrown. December is going to be an exciting time to talk about it, but what I hear you saying is that our asset allocation process for private equity really needs at some point to have a 5-10 year look out, not just the year-over-year decision for what we should shoot for in the intermediate term, right?
Well, we're to be clear, I think, operating under the assumption that the bogey is 17.5%, and we're just having a very regular dialogue about what's the best way to implement against that as the numbers get bigger.
Yep.
So, we don't want to...
Don't worry. I like it. What I hear you saying is that we have to focus on the strategic issue of how do we actually put that money to play, and you'll take care of, you know, the technicals and how it gets done and the contract negotiation, how we optimize performance, but that we need to think about, you know, what this means if the fund is $120 billion or whatever it will be
right
many years down the line. Okay.
And the resource constraints figure very prominently in that.
Right. Being able to meet the 17.5%, whatever that is. Okay, I hear you on that.
As a follow-on to that, John, I've always been attracted in terms of asset allocation to your orchestra. So remind me, you're a private equity.
Lead guitar.
Lead guitar.
And they're saying they don't have enough fingers and the guitar might get too big.
Thank you.
So just real quick, one last slide. Slide 21 speaks to sort of lays out the initiatives we want to execute against. Obviously, as Tom just outlined, number one, from an investment standpoint, this range, $2.5 to $3.5 billion, feels like the right range the next couple of years, really, as we continue to work off our long-dated exposures. Number two, as I highlighted earlier in the attribution discussion, you know, we really want to place an increased focus on our fee and carry load going forward. Now, that can mean a number of different things. First and foremost, we continue to get the benefit based on our size and our ability to show up for a first close of management fee discounts. I think it's a pretty interesting dynamic that that's become sort of a permanent part of the fundraising landscape. Obviously, in a market this hot, I don't know that those discounts need to be offered, but we're still asking for them, we're still getting them, and where appropriate and possible, we'll continue to pursue that. Secondly, and this is the area we'll focus mostly on over the next year, in 2016, on a limited experimental basis, we had some success structuring some sidecars alongside some of our fund commitments that allowed us to get after some pretty aggressive carry concessions. Now, carry, as we all know, that's really where the game is. If we're going to save money, it's going to be carry, not management fee, that gets us there. These concepts, effectively what they look like is they create access to what looks like co-invest no fee, no carry access to the exact same deals we're already in. But unlike conventional co-invest, there's no real execution burden on our part. We effectively structure it up front. We take a little bit more concentration risk, which in the context of our entire portfolio is probably not that material. And we give the GP a little bit more discretion. But we can have a meaningful impact on carry in those situations, and we can deliver it within the context of our current resourcing, our current approvals process. Because, again, in the end, we just need to negotiate a little bit harder and do some structuring on the front end, but ultimately it just looks like a regular way fund commitment. On the basis of the limited experimentation we did in 16, we sort of rolled that out and started talking about it with more of our GPs over the course of the year. And this is an area where I think we can make some progress over the course of the year. I think we can actually deliver some more capital behind these structures over the course of the year. It's only ever going to work for a subset of our managers, really a subset of our middle market managers, but it's deliverable, it's impactful, so we're going to spend a lot of time on it. Longer term, I think we need to be mindful that there's a whole host of solutions. I'm not of the mind that there's one-size-fits-all magic bullet. Anything that gets after better economics is something that should be on the table. So we'll continue to look at co-investment implementation, separate accounts, or any other type of innovative structures that get at savings. This is, again, a longer-term initiative because, you know, it's going to require some innovation, and it's hard to say when something's actually going to punch through and be actionable. But it's something we talk about with Torrey Cove all the time. In collaboration across the alternatives program with the other asset class teams, we're always talking about these issues. So we'll continue to put a lot of focus on it and hope to eventually have something to offer on that front. So there's more on the page, but hopefully the rest of it is reasonably self-explanatory. So we'll pause there. Happy to take any additional questions. I see the clock. We're running out of time. So, I'll stop.
I didn't realize those are little clocks. That's good.
It says
10. Oh, you stuck the landing, Mike.
I do have a question. So for you, John Sherman, in the spectrum of all this stuff in private equity, there's a big range of risk and reward. Remind me where venture fits into that, or we just put that into opportunistic.
So venture is that the far side of that range, right?
The lead guitar.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
The small string.
Any other questions for Tom and Mike? Thank you. We always look forward to this annual review. See you next year. And in December when we do asset allocation. All right. Tony. I think Tony and Austin, right? Tony, I'll note that often the private equity guys gobble up your time on the agenda. Mike saved me having to defend your time today.
I wasn't going to complain if they did. I often think of ourselves as the little brother in the private equity program. Well, so good morning and welcome to our new newest members. So by way of introduction, I'm Tony Breaux, and I am effectively managed by the real estate portfolio here at Roper. To my right is Austin Carmichael, another staff member and real estate investment officer. Immediately to my left is PCA, the OIC's investment consulting for the real estate portfolio, is David Glickman. Dylan Lord up to his left, and it should be noted, Christy Fields is the other principal in the back end. I'm not colorblind, but I'm not good at colors. The bluish teal color.
You can just say she's the smart one.
She is the smart one to keep us on our rails. By way of how we'll work through this is Austin will be covering the basic portfolio attributes, exposures. I'll then cover the 2016 initiatives, changes we're undergoing, as well as the 2017 look forward year-term initiatives. Coupled on to the end is the macro picture, state of the markets, as well as dovetailing with the real estate portfolios initiatives done by the consulting team. But I did want to do a quick preamble right now. As SaaS and an consultant is in an early stage of what I would term a pivot, in which we're moving towards a more less volatile portfolio and more fundamental real estate return attributes. And starting in mid-2015 and then up to very recently, codified by the OSC in April of last year, we restated our policy objectives, which was much of initially a top-down approach, working with our CIO and saying, where does the real estate program fit within a broad multi-asset portfolio? And then a tops-up or a bottoms-up approach, working with John Hershey at the program level and consultant on what are the implementation and different ways to get there. So I just wanted to read real quickly to start and frame the discussion the policy objectives of the real estate portfolio, and hopefully that provides a little bit of context as we walk through the slides. And as a upfront, I don't think we'll take up our full allotted minutes. So we've got lots of time for questions and interplay if there's any that come up whatsoever from the council. Policy objectives directly for real estate are, one, to improve the overall diversification of OPERF by reducing the real estate portfolio's embedded equity, long-winded way of saying increase the diversification by decreasing the sensitivity to OPERF's public and private equity allocations. Secondly, we're repositioning the portfolio in early stage and implementation to increase the component of returns through current income, which should moderate our overall volatility as well as bring in a component of inflation protection. With that, I will turn over to Austin Carmichael.
Thank you. So we'll kind of put through some slides in our presentation, and we'll spend time on every slide, and of course interrupt with our questions at any point you want to emphasize. So if you want to jump to slide 3, I'll focus on kind of just the recap of where the program ended up in 2016. So as Tony alluded to, March was kind of represented a pivot point for us, where we shifted from, that's where we codified the pivot and the new strategic plan, focusing more on longer duration holds, more income oriented, a little less opportunistic. And so kind of capturing our we made 4 commitments last year totaling $1.1 billion, which is fairly consistent to prior years, our average the prior 9 years to this. We actually average $850 million a year in commitments, so we're in range of what we've committed in the past. The biggest difference is we've committed to, we're making larger, more scalable commitments to partnerships that we can scale up with our limited staffing resources. That's going to be a theme you'll hear from us a few times in this presentation, is the need to find more scalable partnerships and ramp up what we can commit to. So, and just highlight that 50% of the commitments in last year were to core, 50% were non-core, and going forward, our big emphasis will be on the core and a little bit of value add going forward. We'll be the primary focus that you'll see from us in our deal flow. And we spent a good portion of the second half of last year underwriting Odyssey funds. Those are the core open-ended universe. We made our first recommendation, which was approved by the council in December. And we are pretty far along in our underwriting on where we anticipate bringing 3 additional recommendations over the next few months to this committee. If you want to jump to quickly, we'll just touch on slide 4. The point here on this just shows the net cash flows for the real estate program. The takeaway here is that it's for the last 4 or 5 years, it has been a net positive cash flow for the program, for OPERF, and the projection is that will continue going forward. On slide 5, we captured just a quick snapshot. 2 key takeaways here. We're at 12.6% of the program with the target of 12.5, so we're essentially fully allocated right where we want to be. The other takeaway is we've got 47 active relationships within the real estate program. Again, we are on what we term a relationship diet. We're very selective on adding new names. We're going to be letting a lot of the, especially commingled funds that are running their life cycle and this will burn down, and focus on you know, if we add any new names, they're going to be things that we can scale up, and that's going to be the focus going forward. Slide six, we just captured the snapshot of the performance as of June 30. And our private markets were always lagging and how soon we get our data, so it's a little stale, but in fact, we just got the Q3 numbers in yesterday, so we didn't have a chance to update this by then. But so we showed you two benchmarks here. That's the one change that took place as well with the change back in March of last year. Is our benchmark change. So we decided to go and show both the old one and the new benchmark here. And all returns here are shown net of fees. And so that's an important point there. The, you know, just top line, you know, our core has performed very well, of course, across all periods. The value add has performed well over the short and medium terms. The 10-year numbers have underperformed. That includes, you know, some of the prior GFC commitments that were made. Opportunistic has underperformed over all those periods shown there, and that's going to be taking a lower focus of our investment program going forward. No questions there. We'll move on to slide seven. This kind of captures, again, the change from in our program. You know, we show the prior weightings for each of the sub-strategies and then the revisions. And then the snapshot under the actual column, that captures where we are as of June 30. And then just the arrows are the obvious indications of where we're focusing and where our new commitments are going to be going forward. So, you know, we're going to be focused primarily on increasing our core because we're actually under-allocated the new guidelines there. The REITs we will be bringing down. The value added is kind of basically going to try to remain neutral around there, and opportunistic will be coming down. And our pipeline for going forward does not contain any actual opportunistic, so that's going to be on a glide path to be brought down.
As a new member, I'm going to be cautious.
Will you turn on your mic?
Oh.
All right.
First,
now you did.
As a new member, I'll probably be cautious in my questions. But if I can go back to slide six just for a minute. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to understand what this is telling. So the overall returns, for example, the first year are 9.86, and does this slide suggest that the overall benchmark is, for example, in 1 year, a column at 11.3? So I guess overall I'm asking, is real estate at above or below our benchmarks, both in the short term and the long term?
For the long term, if you look at our new, if you look at the 10-year number, it's above the new benchmark. So the Odyssey, which is the Odyssey plus 50 basis points. So that, you know, we performed 6% 10 years. 5.69 was the benchmark for that period. The shorter periods, it has underperformed.
Okay. Thank you. I understand that.
So Austin, though, can you and Tony explain why the blowout of 150 basis points on the short end? What's causing that? Do you have a sense of what's driving it?
That's an area that we need to spend a little bit more time doing a little bit better analysis on, to be frank. I think there's a couple of areas that we intuitively would point to. Were you asking about the shorter term? Or
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
so
one.
This looks like one fund cycle to me, right? So just eyeballing the difference.
Yeah, I mean, I can provide a quick thing. I do look in context and say 1 year number, while it has, if we try to explain it, it's certainly not as meaningful as real estate. We have quite a bit of J curve effect that occurs in 1 year. We've got a lot of significant exposure that occurred during the 05, 06, and 07 vintage years when real estate went from a 5% portfolio up to 12.5% target now with the plan, coupled in with the high opportunistic tilt that it had at that time, and it really, you see the opportunistic number there. burrowing further down into the attribution is a very challenging exercise, one that we're glad to do, but also with this pivot and changing our portfolio structure, these numbers become less meaningful as we start implementing more core.
Right, but 05, 06 would be in the 10-year, right? So that would be the 10-year number.
But we do have a significant amount of legacy assets and relationships still sitting in our opportunistic and value-add portfolio that value-add's had a little bit better time curing itself because they can get to stabilizations. Investors are seeking yield. Mm-hmm. Opportunistic, if it was broken then and you didn't fix it, it's sitting there languishing now and waiting for debt to roll and send it back to the bank. Still, there's still challenges in that space for our legacy investments, and I think that's part of that attribution and anchor. Obviously, the public markets move around a bit, too. In this case, they're an added benefit for the one year. But
might be the right time for me to ask the question I've been thinking about for a bit. Could you talk some more about the pace at which this pivot is proceeding more towards the core, if I'm understanding it correctly, and those dynamics you're mentioning, how that affects how you take that on?
I think both PCA would touch on that too, but I would call it methodical. We're not fast moving, implementing everything in a very short term. And that's where the pivot comes into play. I do think this is more of a pivot than a 180-degree shift done simultaneously. So we are fortunate enough to be in a cycle, too, that I think the changes being made to the portfolio will work out well. Core real estate, as you get further into cycles, becoming more opportunistic. It faces even more challenges as you face timing needs and inflation, whatever else comes next down the pike. But,
Thanks.
Can we circle back to the benchmark question? And I just want to zero in on this because I want to make sure we understand it. So the new benchmark is the more core-driven benchmark. And so the timing for using it to determine performance will be basically a year ago forward, right? Because the past had the opportunistic and other, the sort of more return-seeking profile in the real estate portfolio.
Correct. So, I mean, to be very precise, the new benchmark isn't germane to any of these comparisons.
Okay, so
because our first money in the ground post pivot occurred after June 30th, 2016.
Okay, so as we look at so looking at the prior benchmark, then what it's saying is even with the opportunistic problem, we underperformed the benchmark
pretty much
at all those. Okay.
And it's important to note both benchmarks are core real estate. The NPI is still run by Nate Creef. It's the National Property Index, and it's a basket, a much larger basket of an odyssey of core mandates, including all of our programs that feed into the return data. It's difficult to unwind it. It's not investable. It's hard to look at the attributes and understand precisely what's in there. Every mandate is different from amounts of leverage. Odyssey is a basket of the 24. It's investable, so that's very important to us, and has 24 component funds and roughly $180 billion of assets in there. And so that's the component difference.
If I may add two other data points that might help you interpolate. The old benchmark is reported gross of fees. So in order to compare it to the performance of the fund, you should take off somewhere between 90 and 110 basis points to make it a net number. The data service, the database, doesn't report a fee because these results are at the property level rather than at the fund level or at the separate account level.
So when Tony said these were net of fees, it was just our return that are net. That's net of fees.
Our returns are net of fees, and there's been a net of fee inclusion with the new benchmark because Odyssey, unlike NPI, to make it more complicated, does report both gross and net. So all of the rows down through new benchmark are net.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The second point of departure between the portfolio and the index is the NPI index of properties only reports results at the gross property level before leverage. So the performance results that you see are what the unlevered properties deliver. In times when interest rates are falling, the leverage property returns, including your portfolio and including the data in the new benchmark, are going to be advantaged. And when interest rates are rising, you're going to be disadvantaged. And that will influence and make it a little bit more difficult to try to compare one against another. Going forward, the level of leverage in the new benchmark is a lot closer to the level of leverage that you have currently in your portfolio. And as time goes on, and the portfolio shifts more and more to the core-type assets that Tony Austin described, the level of leverage will begin to more closely resemble the level of leverage in the benchmark as well. So that's another way that it's going to become more relevant.
So circling back to Rick's question, which was, how do we read this? If the new benchmark applies from this point going forward, you're saying the prior benchmark, comparing our performance to that is about close?
That's
a technical term.
It may not be a lot of information.
Does that help, Rick?
There is. real estate's made tremendous headways in providing analytics and attribution data to core real estate. As we implement more core into our portfolio, we'll be bringing a data consultant recommendation in the subsequent months, and I'll talk about that later as well. We'll have much more transparency to our returns and getting closer to basis point understanding of our variances, where regards opportunistic and closed-end funds is much more challenging. It's much more similar to private equity and difficult to get that data pulled out.
Continuing on, actually slides 8 through 11, I won't spend much time on, I'll kind of skip over those. That just shows the diversification for the portfolio by property type, by geography, and by manager type. By manager. Key takeaway there is the portfolio is well diversified by all those components. Just would note that, you know, as we pivot and seek greater size relationships and scalable relationships, the manager concentration will actually become a little less over time, and as we let some of these smaller older vintage funds burn off and focus on more for like separate accounts and the odds of funds that we can scale up, we will have to be a little bit more concentrated by manager type of accounts.
Austin, if I may, on the hotel side, remind me, are these investments in the properties themselves and the land, or investments in the operating companies?
Within our, the hotel components?
Yeah.
It could be both, depending on the fund manager and their strategy. Some will separate the operating company, and some will invest in the operating company themselves.
Our existing holdings within the opportunistic bucket, we own both the operating companies through the funds as well as the underlying real estate. On the core side, generally not the operating company, but it's a very small component of the index. I think it was around 2% or so. Thank you.
So slide 12, we just show the leverage compliance by each strategy. And the takeaway there is, across all strategies, the portfolio is within policy guidelines. And then 13, again, is just a recap of to make sure that we're in compliance across different components. And the key there is that there's in compliance across all components. And we are reporting back to you too of. The program does have the ability for our separate accounts to invest in what we call non-mandates, and we are required to report back if any of our managers take advantage of that. I can explain that if you want to hear that, but the takeaway is that we do have one manager who did invest across two properties there. I'll turn it over to Tony to talk through going forward with some of our initiatives.
I did want to direct I'll try not to go slide by slide as much, but as mentioned, Ken. But under slide 14, this is it's more underlying need to the way the chart flows down and shown as portfolio composition. What we're staff's trying to show here is really showcasing, again, it is something you can common theme across the private markets. However, in real estate's case, we really have a relationship diet that's, or budget that's instilled as part of our go-forward in order to manage both staffing and allocations and manager oversight. Couple that with a shift towards more scalable partnerships, since we have the luxury of being able to do that within large open-end funds as well as separate accounts that we tailor-made to our own specifications. The important parts of the second half of the slide, ongoing managers are, so the tables add up if you add each of the numbers together to the 47 manager relationships we have that I think was shown on slide 5 perhaps. That's our total headcount. However, for those are broken down into their constituent makeup, we have the top level are ongoing. These are very strategic. They fit the role of the real estate program. They're either tailored specifically to meet those objectives, or in the opportunistic case, they're strong performers that complement the other parts of our portfolio. Legacy relationship and managers are those that really don't do that, whether it's performance reasons and look backs, or it's investment behavior, GP selection, a number of attributes, as well as those that truly don't fit within real estate. Some are much more private equity, like they don't invest in real estate, operating company intensive, and performance. And then lastly, the other slides show what we're trying to accomplish here in the near term, which dovetails into the next slides that we can go over. From a macro perspective, which I won't steal any of PCA's thunder down the road here, is real estate's in a luxurious spot. We've had very strong capital appreciation over the last 5 or 6 years coming out of the downturn, particularly as there's a lot of new entrants into the space, and people have been reallocating capital to a greater preponderance of real estate exposure in their portfolios. Add that to the continued seeking of yield, and we've had a good run of it. More important to that, though, is I think that the primary fundamentals that drive real estate returns are always supply and demand. And it's the last few years have been a very beneficial and really fascinating time to work in the industry, in which we have a very strong demand, and supply has been very in check. We didn't have the downturn had some real estate. It was credit-related and more on the single-family homes from a commercial standpoint. Supply was never overbuilt, and so there's tremendous opportunity still for very steady and measured rental growth going forward, but as we'll state on in the next parts, we don't expect the capital appreciation returns to be part of the, as we get later into the cycle here, it'll be very much driven by continued growth and protection of your income streams. From the current perspective right now on the staffing, you're looking at the staffing, so I don't need to go much past that. We did lose one third of our staff, but in a positive manner. We had Carmen Leva is now working down in the executive door. Darren's part of the portfolios. Down the treasury in Salem, so we'll be looking for a new real estate coordinator after 8 years of Carmen having to manage myself and Brad and myself and Austin over the last few years. The portfolio composition, again, I just want to drive home the idea that we're under a relationship budget, but more importantly than that, it's really the idea of scaling up our partnerships, as well as a tilt to ongoing core real estate exposures. To couple that in, it's that bass guitar role, and that's what real estate plays in our 70s rock band analogy that works exceedingly well as we try to explain our behavior patterns to the entire planet. The initiatives at each of the levels, obviously, we've just been through that, so I won't go too much further. You can read that on there, but it's remained pretty flat in the value add. We're letting our opportunistic wind its way down to get within slighter targets. I don't see any missed opportunities in opportunistic real estate at the moment, so from a timing perspective, while we're not market timers, it's not a bad time to let that sit and really concentrate on our fundamental part of the portfolio, which is the core part of the program. And the public REITs is something that we're actually working on right now, and that's as we gained additional staffing, especially in the middle and back office parts of it. Investment operations is working with our new senior investment analyst that works across the alternatives portfolio and looking at how we'll implement a wind down in our public REITs and then what role they can play going further forward to try to diversify our exposure types against the private market holdings that we have. So that'll be an exercise we're doing in Q1, Q2, and see when the timing comes out of that. And the only thing I should say in wrap up is there's a couple things I did leave off the slides that were unintentional that I should have put in. I made mention to the fact that we are spent a considerable amount of time this last year and a half working with a number of different data providers that have a tremendous amount of transparency down into the core operating real estate. They usually do that through the appraisal processes in which the way real estate runs. You generally work Argus models or different ones that have the entire picture of the underlying properties and their rent and cash flows and all the subtle nuances that go into running a property. Bring that up to the portfolio level. They have that amount of detail because they're running the appraisals, so they're capturing a lot of data. Doing the same thing and replicating that in the $180 billion worth of Odyssey or open-end diversified core equity funds, we will have a much better tool at our disposal down the road as we continue working with these and try to bring one on board that provides a better snapshot of our portfolio attributes, our exposures, where our risks are. But that being said, we have to push this up to our chain. We have been doing internal research at the lower staff levels, and we'll be moving that up through the CIO in the coming months. And you'll see the product that makes it through our final fitting here over the coming months. And then the last one is strides that have been made at more of the alternatives portfolio or program level. Just internal resources have been reallocated, in which we're spending a greater part of our time on and much deeper diligence efforts, as well as reviews of the ongoing partnerships and forward-looking as we underwrite new partnerships. And all that's a John Hershey sale to the board. It should go without saying that we have shifted quite a bit of the way we're functioning internally and how we face power to the markets. And lastly, I guess if I had to just give a few takeaways to provide a snapshot as there, if you're going to take anything home, it's we're sitting in a market that's had strong returns. Don't expect the same capital appreciation returns. I'm not tempering enthusiasm or saying we can't make a bogey, but on the other hand, capital appreciation has been an amazing tailwind, and going forward it's going to be about focusing on that income and trying to create gains there. The appreciation will do what it does in the capital markets.
So just picking up on John's question is very interesting. I was a little surprised. And again, I have a lot to learn. The question was about hotels, how much of the investment was an operating company versus property. As an asset class, do you have an idea of how much of this investment represents real property versus operating business in this sector?
Strip down the entire hotel.
The entire, beyond hotels, the entire portfolio. And if it's, the reason why I ask is that they're really two separate kinds of businesses operating strategies, risks, leverage, and should be measured with different.
There is a slide on here that does a quick attribution of our return data. Sorry, I'm paging through to get through it. I think at the bottom of page 9 does a better job explaining the tilts that are in our portfolio, with a significant part of the value and opportunistic being in this massive lump called other. And disproportionate. We'll have much smaller other going forward. But there is a anything that has down under private equity real estate is predominantly operating companies sitting there, and that's a good portion of our portfolio. Breaking that up is more challenging. Just getting the attribute out of the closed-end opportunistic fund data isn't as simple as it appears.
Okay. I can take the rest of it offline, but I just found it different. Because when I looked at this portfolio, I assumed that it was all real estate.
Well, if some of our private partnerships, take Hilton private, then bring it back public. We own, 3% or 5% of the fund that has that, and a number of those are replicated across the portfolio, which is both an operating company and underlying real estate and then franchises. So it's getting to the basis points is a little tough, but there are components as well.
Mr. Roller, your question gets really to the heart of why we advocated in favor of this pivot, and that is we want to capture the most genuine real estate data. And what we realized is the portfolio had multiple betas. And we said the role in the portfolio is to play bass guitar. And we realized that some of these exposures were really lead guitar and drag. And so the process that the team has gone through with support from DCA has carefully examined all these different betas, all these different exposures, and slowly and methodically get towards the genuine real estate beta, which is primarily core, income-driven, inflation-sensitive, low duration, etc.
My turn?
Your turn.
Okay. Well, according to this marker, Rukaya, we have 8 minutes remaining to do our 2-hour presentation.
I'd have you as having 12 more minutes.
Yeah, but I take 5 for questions.
So. Oh, all right.
So, I'm David Glickman. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk a little bit about what we believe as your consultants are what we call a SWOT assessment, the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, so that you get a little bit of a picture. And then Dylan's going to talk about the domestic private markets, some of which Tony and Austin have alluded to. And then if there's time remaining, we're glad to talk about the public market REITs and the international markets in which you have investments too as part of the Q&A. The team at PCA has been working with staff and the OIC. We're beginning our 4th year on the real estate portfolio. Our primary role is to assist in the design and implementation of a real estate strategy that, as John mentioned, supports the rest of the portfolio and helps contribute to the mission of the council. Now, bass guitar is not so bad. You got Paul McCartney, you got Sting, so, you know, it's not so bad.
What was the question here?
As has been described, the portfolio and the staff and the markets are performing, and that's a good thing. You're at your target allocation. You are not in a position, as some funds are, where you have to force money into a market during a relatively short period of time. So the dollar cost averaging aspects are going to be beneficial to you as a long-term investor. As John said, as Tony said, I'm going to say it one more time in my limited time, the markets are not going to give you the same level of returns that you've enjoyed during the past 5, 6, 7 years. That's not going to happen. There continues to be competition to buy the properties. The fundamentals are pretty good, as Dylan will allude to, but we've had this wonderful wind at our back, and it's very unlikely that that's going to continue. Part of the reason it's worked is because the choices that investors had outside of real estate weren't as plentiful or as desirable, and so the money came to real estate. That may not be the case going forward. Let's talk about the strengths. This is a private market. Like private equity, relationships in real estate are your destiny. And one of the strengths that the OIC has is the set of relationships that have been developed over the last 20 years. What this allows you to do is to access the best management teams and to speak and be heard at the largest open-end funds with a high degree of reliability. And that, in turn, allows you to create structures which hopefully will give you positive selection bias and allow for terms that are advantageous to you as a customer. Another advantage that you have is that you are a long-term investor with patient capital. And as more of the portfolio shifts towards core long-term investments, less relying on market timing of getting in and out of a property as part of a value add or an opportunistic, that long-term and patient outlook will serve you well and is a strength. The last strength that I'm going to point to is that you have systematically begun to reduce risk in your real estate investments through a variety of things. There's less now than there was 4 years ago, and 4 years from now there will be even less. To your question, Mr. Treasurer, we would expect that we are 1 year into a 4 to 5 year program of converting these private, illiquid, lumpy assets from one point to what we want it to be. In terms of the weaknesses that we, as your consultant, would point out, this is not news. You have a small staff, and they have a very ambitious menu in front of them. You have a global portfolio. You have to be smart about lots of different markets, and there's just so many hours in the day. The other two weaknesses we see that are being corrected are you have indirect operational risk because you employ managers to actually do the day-to-day operations of your properties. To the extent that there are changes over which you have no control in those management companies, we call that indirect operational risk. The last is that your portfolio has a higher degree of leverage than your benchmark does. It's coming down, and that's with intent, but for the next 2 to 3 years, in comparison, for example, you have about twice as much leverage loan-to-value that the benchmark properties do. In terms of opportunities, one opportunity we see is that you now have a clear direction for pursuing real estate as an integrated part of the overall portfolio. That wasn't nearly as clear before. So you have the chance to continue to reduce risk, and you have more tools, as Tony was describing, that will be coming to be used to help monitor and manage the portfolio in a way that we think may not add all that much extra value in terms of performance in nominal terms, but on a risk-adjusted basis is going to reduce your risk and make it a better portfolio. In terms of opportunities, by shifting to a more income-oriented portfolio, you'll have more reliability when it comes to your main mission, which is paying benefits. The threats that we would see are that, one, the markets aren't going to produce what they did. We talked about that. And that you have the risk of Tony and Austin, you know, winning the lottery and deciding to become shepherds, in which case you don't have much bench strength in this area. And then the third risk is a difficult one to quantify, but we would be remiss if we didn't point out. The real estate markets and all the capital markets face a great deal more uncertainty than they did a year ago. And things that translate into real estate operating risk or real estate performance risk include currency, trade policies, which affect the demand for space both here and overseas, changes in the banking laws that would allow for more liberal lending, which in turn might stimulate more new speculative construction. We don't know the answers to any of these things, how much or how quickly. We do know that they're likely to have an impact going forward. So with that, I'm going to turn it to Dylan and ask him to talk briefly about current market conditions.
In the interest of time, before I launch into the market dynamics, are there any questions that you would like us to address before we wrap up?
Dylan, you're important to us, so we'll take the time that you need. So don't feel like you're constrained. I'll cut time from John Sherman at the back. So you've flown out from New York. We really appreciate your time. So.
Well, unfortunately, my three colleagues stole most of my interesting talking points. But I'll talk a little bit about the market. So as was already alluded to, real estate right now has very strong tailwinds, both from a capital market and a space market perspective. The space markets are very supportive. We're going on 6 years of positive absorption, as you've seen in your results and your benchmark. We've had double-digit returns from low-leverage, stabilized, income-producing assets, which, as David pointed out, isn't something that we should get too comfortable with. Returns are currently moderating. Part of that is driven by the fact that though demand continues to outpace supply, cap rates have not continued to compress at the rate that they historically have. As a result, there's less appreciation associated with these investments, and future allocations of capital need to be focused on the ability to generate operational efficiencies and drive rents. Real estate, by and large, is well positioned in this regard. There are some headwinds unrelated to all of the risks that David described, but changes in consumer habits, e-commerce are creating both investment opportunities and hazards in industrial and retail. Urbanization and demand for multifamily housing is also creating both opportunities and challenges to existing investments. We think that in this context, it's important to also take into account the capital market environment. Fundraising has been extremely strong across private markets, as your private equity staff recently described. Allocations for private markets for institutional investors, both domestic and international, have gone up. Real estate allocations have shifted from roughly 8% of portfolios to 10%, resulting in meaningful amounts of dry capital in the hands of institutional managers. To give some context to that, it's estimated that dry powder right now is approximately $240 billion versus $140 billion 10 years ago. What that means is that there will be capital to support current pricing, but the ability to deploy that capital into investments that will be accretive to your existing holdings is becoming increasingly challenging. With that in mind, I'd like to wrap up with one little comment, which is that duration and structure matter. They are important components of risk. Lots of us observed during the last downturn that institutions did not fully understand what they owned, how they owned it, what the alignment of interest was, not only with their existing managers, but with the operators to whom those managers had allocated capital. We think this is a very prudent time for you to continue to reduce risk across these characteristics and to develop the tools with which you'll be able to navigate the next downturn.
Pardon me, let me give one at a time a couple of examples in my career that are a puzzle. My buildings currently would sell for about 20 times earnings, about 5% capitalization rate, at a time when Fed funds rates are at all-time low. And so the reason people are interested in that in real estate is because of the income. I mean, I'm borrowing at 2%, and you can sell a building for 5. When I developed PacWest Center in the early 80s, Fed funds were in the stratosphere. But oddly enough, buildings sold for the same cap rate, 5 or 6%, because people were desperate to protect themselves against inflation. So you end up with the same pricing structure, but very, very different reasons for the pricing. So in a sense, the bass guitar issue, are we looking to protect ourselves against inflation or earnings?
Well, in a larger sense, real estate can play several different roles at the same time. And while that makes the metaphor of the band break down a little bit, imagine that your bass guitar can sing too.
Oh, jeez. Tony, I don't know about that.
I guess that was my point. It can serve different objectives that are dramatically different.
Yes, and part of it, John, has to do with the, as Glenn was saying, the duration and the structure. Okay, because you don't have a lot of debt on your properties, okay? A temporary decline in market rents or in vacancy can be withstood. And because your holding period is intended to be a very long one, as opposed to someone who's building to flip and make the capital gain as quickly as possible, that also changes the structure and the picture of what it is that real estate is doing. Real estate is a pretty broad label for an awful lot of things, including operating companies and hotels, as well as CBD office buildings that are leased on a long term to credit tenants.
A good analogy is, and a simplified one, is, you know, look through cycles and invest through cycles. And our real estate is certainly pivoting to do more of that instead of market timing, preponderance, and dependence on closed-end structures that have a lot of fundamental flaws.
If you were cash flow positive, and seriously cash flow positive for many, many years, you would probably come up with a real estate strategy that was more focused on opportunistic and development as opposed to existing core completed buildings. Since you're not, we're trying to create a strategy that meets the needs that you bring to the table.
The other example in 2008, my buildings were worth about 60% of what they would have been worth in 2005 within the recession. But I had absolutely no credit risk. Those buildings earned exactly the same in 2008 as they did in 2005. But I didn't have to mark them to market. But we do, don't we? So it's an odd circumstance where we're having to mark things to market that we're buying for income, and the income is unchanged.
Yes, in that way it diverges from just being a bond where you say, no, our intent is to hold to maturity and therefore we want to value it at par. You do have the luxury of being a longer-term investor, and we caution all of our clients to understand that quarterly marks in real estate are a little less reliable than what the Dow Jones will tell you at 4 o'clock Eastern on any given day, and that you should look over a longer period of time. And while one-year returns are important, given that a real estate ownership cycle of a completed and leased building probably averages 7 years, a little longer focal point is probably not a bad thing to use when trying to compare real estate results.
If you're looking for income, if you're looking for capital appreciation, that's a different circumstance.
Then you're playing lead again.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you, real estate team. I'm going to take a break. I'll see you at 2 minutes after.
I've heard good things about you from a guy named
Moving along, John Hershey, I believe you are up.
The gavel is on.
Okay, so John Hershey, Director of Alternatives. By policy, we're to present and disclose any placement agent contact that staff has had during the calendar year. This is the same format that we used back in 2015, so the same format for 2016. Placement agents are essentially third-party outsourced sales and marketing resources hired by the managers. And so the TAP 5 slide shows the 8 transactions where placement agents had contacted staff. Of those 8, 5 were in private equity and 3 were in the alternatives portfolio. And with that, I'll take any questions. I was trying to think of a rock band analogy here. Roadies, group band. I don't know. I'm struggling. I fear I may torture it, and Rukaya will boo me off the stage.
Like Tom with that trying to get it out thing that he. Any questions for John? Thank you, sir.
Okay, continuing, following up on our recommendations for Russell made last year, we're publishing the proposed schedule way in advance. So you have before you proposed for 2018. It is identical, really, to the dates that we're using this year. So plenty of time to put your calendars and for us to organize all of our meetings accordingly.
John, do you want to give us a deadline for having looked by next meeting?
Sure.
Okay, team. Next meeting, it's under glass, and you must be here on these dates in 2018. Okay. Tom and Mike.
Madam Chair, Treasurer Reed, members of the board, good morning. We're
benefit of the record. My name is Mike Terry. I'm a senior investment officer for Public Equity. My role today is just to be a supporting actor here and emotionally support the tunnel.
So, give all of you something decent to look at.
Tom, you know you're our favorite, right?
What's that?
You didn't need support. You're our favorite.
Well, you know, I was thinking about the band analogy, too, of everyone, and I was thinking, okay, so it's down, fixed income, I'm the drummer, you know, the beat for everybody else. But at the same time, if he knows Spinal Tap, it's the drummer that keeps dying. So, I'm not sure how I handle this, in all honesty.
Are the lights going to show all this or not?
So, to get started, back in December, staff presented a review of OPIRF's fixed income portfolio. And as part of that review, we stated that one of our goals for 2017 was to transfer the government allocation or portfolio that's within fixed income, transition that from externally managed to internally managed. And in preparation for that eventual transition, staff is recommending that the OIC approve amending policy to allow up to 10% maximum gross notional investment in U.S. Treasury, exchange-traded U.S. Treasury futures, or internal managed portfolios. So today's presentation is to provide a little more extensive background for that presentation. So with that said, what I would like to do is really, I think the executive summary on page 3 really provides a good breadth of what we're going to talk about today. So what I'd like to do is we'll go through the executive summary here, and we'll really kind of open it up for questions. The rest of the presentation is really just kind of detail for the summary, and we can kind of go where the council wants to go. So with that said, exchange-traded futures are widely used, highly liquid instruments that are set up to offset counterparty risk. They're structured to offset counterparty risk. As far as the way fixed income intends to utilize U.S. Treasury futures, there are really three ways, two being of primary importance. One, to reduce cash drag on the portfolio, and the other to enhance the ability to adjust interest rate risk in the portfolio. And then finally, as a tool to enhance the performance, the overall structure and performance of the portfolio versus its benchmark. As far as risk management is concerned, there are a number of levels of risk management when it comes to investment staff's ability to manage this type of product. Number one, staff, currently investment staff group, Mr. Vigeri's public equity group, staff has utilized exchange-traded futures for several years now, utilizes them extensively internally. So we do have experience in-house as far as the actual operational management of futures. We now have what we believe is a state-of-the-art risk management system in-house to support staff, not only risk management, but portfolio management system in Aladdin. Additionally, we have four members of the fixed income team with the ability to, with trading ability, trading experience, that would provide constant monitoring. So we have some depth there to the ability to monitor the portfolio. And then finally, we've established investment operations groups, both within Treasury Fixed Income, or excuse me, within Treasury Investment Division, as well as Aladdin, to provide support in terms of middle office and settlement. Importantly, as staff utilizes Treasury futures, they will not use them to add leverage For one thing, leverage is prohibited by current policy. And so when we intended, when we use them, what you'll see is you'll see that any position that we take will be offset fully, any gross notional position that we take will be offset fully by cash. That cash that's sitting there after we enter into a contract, that cash that offsets that notional will be restricted. It will be pulled away from us. We won't be able to enter into a $1 million contract and then go take $1 million in cash and send it somewhere else. And very importantly, we have a compliance team in-house and we have a compliance system at LAC that will monitor these trades on both a pre- and post-trade basis. So if I go and want to enter into an order, the system's going to pre-test that order to make sure that as part of the trade, I don't violate any rules. So with that said, it's staff's recommendation today to the council to amend policy as detailed in Appendix G to allow 10% gross notional investment exposure to exchange traded U.S. Treasury futures.
One comment I'd like to make. We were managing futures internally prior to Aladdin, and that was very kind of work intensive, middle office and back office intensive. We had to sign off on margin sheets, state streets as they approved flow. We were managing spreadsheets, real time spreadsheets, so it was quite a bit of work put on us. With BlackRock Aladdin now, we're able to outsource the vast majority of that to the middle and back office, giving us time to really just concentrate on the portfolio. So we're not, 60% of our day is not taken up by middle office and back office, but we're really able to concentrate on the portfolio. So that's an advantage to us in equity, and it's an advantage definitely fixed income as well.
But isn't it also that there's no back office processes ever?
Absolutely. Yes. We can monitor as well, so we're comfortable with that. So absolutely.
So, Tom, I have one request. So, 10% of the fixed income portfolio is about $1.5 billion, right? What's the?
So, right now, the portfolio would be identified about $1 billion.
The
size of the portfolio.
But the policy for 10%, I'm just trying to get a sense of what the face amount on the
right. It's going to be measuring gross national value.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So one thought about this is that's a pretty big jump, and so I would love to hear from you in 6 months to hear a report back on what you learned, if there were surprises, because fixed income derivatives are a little bit different than equity derivatives. And if there are things that we can do as a board to support whatever you need to continue to roll it out, I think that would be a good idea.
I absolutely agree.
Okay.
One thing I want to underline, we're going to be methodical in this transition. There's no rush to this transition. There's, right now we have a soft target at the end of the first quarter. But I have zero issue with moving that out.
Soft target to get to 10% by 3/31.
No, to transition the portfolio.
Okay.
To transition the portfolio. From external to internal. Mm-hmm. And I have no issue with pushing that out to make sure we're fully ready. And I have no issue, and I don't plan on us pushing the button on futures the very first day. So that's that's. I understand where you're
coming from. Well, you're the expert, so whatever timing you think is best, but would love to hear back if there are things we can do from a board perspective to support continued success.
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
So, is there a motion on the floor?
I would move.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See you in 6 months, Tom.
Thank you.
Have a net asset values and asset allocations for various accounts under the council's oversight. Everything in line. The ongoing exception is the allocation of alternative investments in OPR, which is steadily going higher as Ben and Mike Mueller continue to make those investments. And then I have tab 9.2, which is the forward calendar. This is, of course, always somewhat of a moving target. There are already changes here, but you can see the next few meetings are filling up fast, and we've got lots of good stuff to talk about.
Any other items for the council portion of the agenda? Okay, at this time I'd like to invite public comment, if there is any. Being no public comment, we are gaveled out.
That's what I learned in the legislature.
Yeah.
Well done.